सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू टॉक टू आसिम ख्वाजा, अ प्रोफेसर एट हार्वर्ड केनेडी स्कूल, वेल नोन स्कूल फॉर इकोनॉमिक्स एंड पब्लिक पॉलिसी इन द वर्ल्ड। आसिम ख्वाजा हैज़ बीन वर्किंग ऑन पाकिस्तान वाइल ही इज़ एट हार्वर्ड। He has conducted a fair amount of research funded by DFID on incentives in civil service. Today we're going to discuss three of his papers on incentives to civil service reform, where he has conducted randomized controlled trials to see how incentives work in the civil service. Let's see what Asim Khaja has developed. Welcome, Asim Khaja. I see that I've read three of your papers, which look very interesting, on civil service reform, which is a topic of extreme interest to Pakistan. I've been working on that for a long, long time. We use that in the framework of economic growth and the Planning Commission, too. I think it's also in the Vision 2025. It's a very important subject for the country. Now, you've got some new results in the three papers that I've seen from you. Maybe you've got more. Can you just give us the headline on your results first?
Thank you. It's a great pleasure, Nadeem, to be here. I appreciate it. And thanks for reaching out to me. I should say this work, before I even begin, I should give credit to two individuals who are co-authors of mine in this work, Adnan Khan, who's at the IGC, and Ben Olkin, who's at MIT.
That's so, right. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. That's absolutely correct. Adnan and Ben. Yes. Go ahead.
And so I would say the one-line headline of the set of studies we have, and then inshallah we can get into more detail in each, is that, performance and incentives matter. Absolutely. And so when you think of civil service reform, you could think of two big dimensions of reform. One is selection, get the right people. And that's absolutely right. There's, that's an important aspect. We really focused on the second part, which is conditional on the set of people you have. They may not be the ideal quality you might want. But whatever quality you have, the realistic quality that we get in a country like Pakistan, even with that quality, once you put people in a system where their performance is rewarded, you can get the same people who otherwise you may have not been happy with to actually perform. And I think that's, to me, the biggest headline. And I do think it's very important in a context like Pakistan, because often there is a narrative on Pakistan, which is, which I think, put bluntly, is that Pakistan ki problem ye hai ki Pakistan mein Pakistani hai. Right. And I see like we shouldn't think that way, that no matter who we have. And I, we work with tax collectors, and tax collectors often in the Pakistani context are very maligned. Right. We might say, ye to chor hain, ye kabhi nahi seedhe hoenge. You hear these statements in Pakistan. Ye kaum kabhi nahi sudharegi. And I feel like I don't want to take a stance on that because I haven't studied the selection effect and what that is. But at least I'm saying there's a ray of hope saying, look, even when you think of individuals who may have come through not the ideal process, who may not have the ideal skill set, who may not have the ideal moral compass, whatever that means, even with what, and that's empowering for us, because even with what we have, we can, once you treat them well, once you give them recognition of what they're doing, I think they will deliver. Will they deliver as much as we wanted? That's a different question.
Okay. But tell me, how different is this from the bonuses that we see here on Wall Street? That have obviously led to good results, but they've also had some side effects too. So is this similar to that, or is it different?
So that's a great question. Mm-hmm. So I think, I wanted to first, even though this might be obvious that rewarding people for performance matters, I wanted to lay that to rest, that absolutely it does. Mm-hmm. But now we get into the fun and more interesting part, which is how do you reward, right? And I think there is there's a detail over here which matters. So when you mentioned Wall Street, Wall Street has a particular way of rewarding performance, right? You can think of rewarding performance in education, which might be a very different style. And what we did is, so if you think of the two big papers we have in this, let me kind of, start with those. One dimension is, do you reward just on money? Right? Pecuniary benefit. Mm-hmm. Or do we reward on non-monetary outcomes? So that's one big question. Mm-hmm. And then when you go in the question of reward on money, which is what Wall Street decides to do mostly, then there's a question of how should that reward system look like? Mm-hmm. And the set of papers we have navigate both of these questions. How do you reward on money versus non-money? And how do you reward within each of these, within money, how do you set up the right system? And my sense would be to answer that is absolutely rewarding on money and non-money is both important, but not all things are created equal. So, for instance, in rewarding with money, and maybe we can get to this when we go to the details of that particular paper, when you reward on money, we find that the Wall Street type of bonus actually doesn't work as well as a much simpler scheme. And I'll explain to that when I get into the details of the paper.
Okay. Now, tell me, let's just look at that. You've got two, you said direct and indirect forms of reward. So one is you've got a pecuniary reward, the other is you've got a transfer as a reward, choice of posting as a reward. So can you describe these two schemes and what do they mean?
Absolutely. So I put these in very distinct buckets. I should say that these are two separate papers we did, and within these two schemes, there's choices of what you can do. So we'll get to that hopefully if we have time. But I also wouldn't call them direct and indirect. I'm not sure that's the right word. To me, they're both direct. It's just one rewards you ostensibly on something which
pecuniary
is
pecuniary and non-pecuniary.
I think that's the right way I would think about it. Now, in both of these, what we find, just the highlights, is that in both of these, we find successful impact. In the monetary scheme, where we pay just purely based on money, we get anywhere from 50 to 60% higher rate of collection. And let me explain what I mean by that. So we get about, I'd say, anywhere from 10 to 13, 14% higher tax raised. But when you think of what that means relative to year-on-year growth in tax revenue, that's about a 50 to 60% higher growth than you would have otherwise gotten. So that's a pretty big effect. In the non-pecuniary thing, now, to do this, you obviously are paying money out. You're paying individuals performance pay. You're giving them higher, effectively, bonuses. But you are more than recovering that bonus, basically. In fact, one way to think about this in the financial case is, what is the return on your investment? If you put money in for performance bonuses, how much money do you effectively get out from that? Is this a positive NPV in the way you'd think of a investment? And what we find is that actually, yeah, it's substantially positive, right? The rate of return on these things is higher than, like, what would you get in a bank if you put your money? You'd probably get these days, well, I don't know, 10% maybe if you're lucky. And what we're finding is this kind of financial return is significantly higher than that. You know, it's anywhere upwards of, I'd say, 50 to 100% depending on, and we can again get into the details of that. The non-pecuniary thing, when we pay on transfers, that one gets almost, I'd say, two-thirds of the way to the one with the best scheme we have on the financial side. But here's the interesting thing. You don't spend any money, right? You're simply rewarding civil servants by the promise of the future posting they would get. So that has no financial cost, but it does have a political cost. It does have an administrative cost, right? And I want to kind of acknowledge that. So I think that's the specific of that. Now,
okay, so we got
would it be useful schemes to get into the details of each
we'll
of
get
these?
Into that. So you've got two schemes. You've got a pecuniary scheme where they get like a bonus in the financial system, or like Jensen and Meckling, they get a bonus for their performance. Right. And that obviously is a cost. But nevertheless, all such systems are designed to produce results that cover the costs. They're supposed to be profitable for the enterprise that's giving them. The second system that you've got is that they will have a choice of posting, and we'll get to that, how it's done. But that choice of posting will determine their performance, and they will perform on the basis of that. Now, briefly, tell me, you've done randomized controlled experiments to do this. Can you please describe those briefly? Just, I know it's very technical. I know you can't do that in an audio podcast. So do the best you can.
Absolutely.
Just describing it.
So let me give the version, actually the simpler, higher level version, which I think is very doable, which is, anytime you do a reform, one big challenge is, how do you determine the impact of the reform? Any reform. Now, the reason it's a challenge is, the typical way we do it, the kind of intuitive way, would be to simply say, measure the thing you care about. Let's say in this case, we wanted to raise tax revenue. So we measure tax revenues before the reform. We bring the reform in, and we measure tax revenues after the reform. And you subtract the two. That's the standard style. That's called a single difference, a before and after comparison. The inherent problem with that is that you don't know what other factors would have changed in the economy. In the case of tax, obviously tax payment has a lot to do with the health of the economy in general. And so when you do a before and after comparison, you could have a program which is working or not working. And just because a secular change is positive or negative, you might think of a program as better or worse. So for instance, if the economy is booming, all programs look good. If the economy is in a recession, all programs, including good ones, will look bad. And so the essence of a randomized control trial is basically, we need to create the following comparison, which is we need to know what would have happened without the program during the same duration. We need that counterfactual. Now, the problem is a counterfactual is by definition a counterfactual. You can't observe it. You can't measure it. And so all we need to do good impact studies is to say, what is a good counterfactual? You'll never get the perfect counterfactual, but what is a good counterfactual? Do what you're doing. And a randomized controlled trial is just a very easy way to construct the right counterfactual or the good enough counterfactual. And the way we do it is you don't need to really anything. I mean, one way to construct a counterfactual is to say, okay, imagine you're introducing a tax reform program to certain tax collectors. You can say, let me compare these tax collectors to another set of tax collectors who I think are very similar to these. If you had really detailed knowledge about them, you could compare groups. You could match the groups up. You could say, I know this tax collector is this type. This other tax collector is almost a twin of this person. So let me give the program to one and not the program to the other. And that would be a very good way of doing it. The problem is the information you need to create twins like that is really hard. Instead, you rely on a simple result from mathematics called the central limit theorem, which is as long as you pick randomly from a group, right? The people you pick on average will be the similar in characteristics to the people you don't pick. So effectively, it allows you to create these twins without you having a knowledge of what that their attributes are. That's all that does. And so that's the technique we use. So what we do, how do we actualize this in our studies, in both of these studies? We will basically randomly pick one set of tax collectors from the same pool. We will introduce the program to them. And the other tax collectors, we will keep under business as usual. And then we will compare how they change over time. And this is called a double difference. So we will compare the change for the group we picked, called the treatment group. And we will look at the change of the group we didn't pick, called the control group. And we will subtract the two changes. So it's a difference in differences. Right. That's the estimate.
But tell me, how do you, the treatment group, do you actually make them collect the additional taxes that they're supposed to collect, because the tax policy has not changed? So how do you do that?
Yeah, so there's no additional taxes.
Okay.
Remember, this is a thing, so that's very critical, right? Both people are under exactly the same, in theory, task. You both have to collect the same set of taxes. You have the same set of tools available. The only difference, this is very critical, the only difference between the two of you is how did we reward you at the end of the year for what you did? One group gets a flat wage, the other group gets
the treatment group bonus. Actually gets the bonus.
The treatment group gets the bonus.
It's not a theoretical thing.
It's not a theoretical. No, absolutely. And this is very critical because all of this is work you do in expectation of how you will be rewarded in future.
Now, how do you do the same?
Believable and credible.
Fair enough. How do you do the same thing for transfers?
So that's a very different case now. So now think it's more challenging. So, and the way it's challenging is the design for the performance pay is an individual thing. You can pick one person and give them the new contract, the bonus contract, and the other person as a non-bonus contract. Now, when you do the transfers paper, it is what we call a group-level randomization. It's not an individual randomization. So you create a group of, say, 10 inspectors. And you say, so I take the entire tax department, it's 500-plus or so tax collectors, and I put them in groups of 10, geographically contained. Roughly think of them as geographically contiguous people, right? And what I do is I say some groups are under this new transfer scheme. Those are the treatment groups. And some groups are under business as usual. Now, what happens to a group which is under the new transfer scheme? In that group, we will say you 10 are competing with each other, right? And what will happen is at the end of the year, whichever one of you has collected the most will get to have the first pick of the 10 areas that you are currently in. So it's a restricted choice. It's a choice for the 10 places that we currently have. Think of it like musical chairs. You have a person with 10 little chairs and you're running musical chairs. Instead of randomly stopping, when the music stops, the person who was the best performer gets to sit in whichever of the 10 chairs they want to sit.
The first choice of chairs. Okay.
First choice of chair.
Fair enough.
Once they've picked the chair, the second person picks from the remaining 9 chairs.
But in the experiment, were you actually able to do that? Did the authorities allow you to make the transfers like that?
That's a great question. So a lot of this is about how do you conduct research in a context like ours, right? These are things you need a lot. These studies require a lot of control. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why the sequencing of our papers is the way it is. Mm-hmm. The performance pay paper happened first because, to be honest, all that required was, and that's not trivial at that point, was required the finance department to be willing to pay money for performance.
Right.
This paper was challenging because this second paper, the transfers paper, exactly what you said. Transfers is a highly political process in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So what we were doing was, it's not that transfers don't happen. They happen all the time, except they happen potentially for non-merit-based reasons.
In fact, they happen every week.
They happen every week.
Prime Minister changes secretaries at will, I think more often than his underwear.
Yes, yes. Well, you are far more familiar with that world, Adib, than I am, but absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we had to have enough buy-in from the department and enough mutual trust between us as researchers. And that took, we were now in, this is an ongoing now 8-year relationship with the excise and taxation. Very early on, the excise and taxation department. We've had like 6 or 7 secretaries they also got transferred out during the course of the study. But we had a lot of collaboration with the department's personnel who stayed, the rankers, the individuals are always there. And the secretaries were super helpful as well. But they had to commit to protect the project from political pressures on transfers. And this was not easy. And this took a lot of effort on their part. And we helped as much as we could. But to give them credit, I'm as surprised and I must say pleased as you might be to say that this actually was carried out. Now, it's also, maybe this is one of the highest stake transfers, right? This is excise and taxation. It's property tax. It's not the big tax. It's not. Maybe the stakes were a bit lower.
Okay, fair enough. We trust that you did the methodology well. We know randomized control experiments, and we trust your results that we've got these results that incentives matter. So economic stands vindicated. So you and I both can be pleased. But tell me now, you also say this in your paper, and we all know that this method of performance-based tax collection has been around since the Roman times or whatever, since forever, right? And one of the most important examples of this that I have is the Sheriff of Nottingham. So can you please tell us how, go back in history and tell us, lay some context to the
universe. Absolutely. So so there's a reason we call this paper Tax Farming Redux. Mm-hmm. Because it's very interesting, and I think we need to be very clear what the message is over here. The message isn't we should introduce performance pay everywhere. Mm-hmm. But the message is that, look, all of these things should be tested. And in some contexts, they'll work well. In other contexts, they may work terribly, right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at the history of tax collection and tax farming, I mean, we can go to colonial India, right? I mean, when the British came in and they appointed, effectively what they were doing was they were appointing tax collectors who were heading districts or regions. And the Mughals did this even before the British. Mm-hmm. And it was a fully incentivized contract, which is, we just want you to give a certain amount of money. Whatever you do, you keep.
Yeah, it's called the Mansabdari system. Yeah, of course.
Mansabdari system. Mm-hmm. So the history of tax farming is very much high incentives in tax collection. Mm-hmm. Now, the downside of a system like that, why is it one of the first people who got guillotined in France in the French Revolution were tax collectors, right? Yep. There's a reason for that. And why there's a word in the U.S. when U.S. has a history of tax collection. So, for instance, the IRS does not have performance pay quite the same way as we did. Absolutely not, right? Mm-hmm. In the U.S. history, you have a word called tax ferrets. When the U.S. tried to introduce tax collectors who are highly incentivized, mm-hmm. the danger was that you were destroying the taxpayer morale, right? You are disrupting the political equilibrium. There's a notion of a Weberian bureaucrat. The Weberian bureaucrat is a bureaucrat who works in social good.
Yep.
And you don't want to reward in this kind of commercial, private sector-y way, right? Yeah. You destroy the ethic of it. You destroy his morale. You destroy the citizen's morale. So that's a real issue. And we were very worried. We were very worried if you could you run the risk of over-incentivizing, right? Taxation is one thing, extortion is another thing. So could you get a situation where the tax collector is so concerned about raising money that they're unfair? They apply the rules of taxation unfairly. But even think of a case where the taxation rule is fair, but you might have humanity. You look at a woman who is struggling. You know, maybe you want a tax collector to be able to go and say, you know what, even though she is due this tax and the law says she's due this tax, I actually think for the health of the state, for the fundamentals of what the social compact the citizen has with the state, I should forgive her, right? So is there a danger that you will create this rapacious tax system? So how did we deal with that? So we said, okay, we're going to do the following. We're very aware of this. So we're going to have three different systems. So I bundled this together and called it performance pay. Actually, there were three very different schemes. One was a scheme. So we do two things. We changed schemes which were more nuanced to these issues, and we also measured things carefully. We didn't just measure money collected. We said the objective function of the tax department and of the government is not just to raise tax money. It's to raise tax money, to be fair, to not create a lot of political unhappiness. Okay, all three things are important, right? Otherwise, you can put a gun on someone's head and raise tax money. That's not the way the state should be operating. So we said, whatever we do, we're going to judge our success by these three dimensions. Tax money raised, citizen satisfaction. No one likes paying taxes, but you could be more or less upset. And third, fairness of the tax system. What tax were you due, and did you get over or under tax? So we had three different ways of measuring these things. I'll explain that in more detail later on. That's one thing we did. To see if there are any perverse consequences from raising taxes. The second thing we did was we had one scheme which only rewarded the tax collector for money raised, nothing else. We had a second scheme which said, okay, that SERF scheme was the simplest and the most objective. Simply a mathematical formula, you raise this much tax, you'll get X percent back from it. Very easy to understand. The second scheme we said, we're going to reward you not just on tax collected, but on these two other dimensions. Fairness, if you overtax someone or you undertax someone, we will penalize you. So remember, if you overtax someone, you're being rewarded for more tax money, but you'll get penalized in the scheme for being unfairly extorting someone. The third thing we also said is we will take customer satisfaction. If you raise taxes, but you really get people upset, right, you'll get penalized. So that's scheme number two. That was called Revenue Plus. The first scheme was called just Revenue. Then we had a third scheme. We said maybe it's even more subtle. That's like the Wall Street bonus. We said you are going to be assessed at the end of the year on a range of factors, which include tax collection, but it could also include disruption, being someone aapne badtameezi kar di, kisi ne aapki shikayat kar di ki ye tax liya isne meri badi zyadti ki mere sath, meri dukaan band kar di, mera itna nuksan ho gaya. So those complaints can be factored in. So now we have different measures, and we have different schemes. And our test was, which scheme will perform the best in terms of all the outcomes? And what was really interesting to us, and this was kind of a revelation to us, is the scheme which was the simplest, revenue only, worked the best, obviously in terms of raising revenue, because there was no confusion about it. But there was no additional citizen cost. And so we were puzzled by that. Why did that happen? Why is it the case that we're not getting this political disruption? And I think what we forgot is, and this is a very big lesson from the principal agent framework, right? Standard framework economics, which is the principal agent framework is the government wants to do something, and the agent in this case, the tax collector, wants something else. And incentives work when there's a difference of their objectives. Okay? If the objectives are the same, there's no problem. What we assumed was the political objectives were different between the two. It turns out they're actually not. The tax collector is very politically sophisticated. They also don't want to piss off anyone. Because guess what will happen when they do, right? And so we needed to give them incentives to raise more money. But in our context, we didn't need to give them incentives to be politically savvy. They were already politically savvy. In fact, it's really interesting what happens. How do they raise money, right? You could ask that question, right? Katika, so now the question becomes, you raise money and you didn't upset anyone. How is that possible, right? In fact, think of what the state would love. If I could give you an exchange rate between revenue, tax revenue, and political costs. Hame yehi dar hota hai na? Ki hum tax table change kar denge, ya tax rate change kar denge, aur log sadkon pe aake tire jalayenge. But tire jalana ek cheez hoti hai, aur vote na dena ek aur cheez hoti hai. Hum tire jalane se dar jate hain kai bar. Maybe it's just tire jalane, aur kal ko wo chup kaake ghar ja jayenge, right? So what these guys do, and this was really interesting to me, and it shows how sophisticated tax collectors are, or agents in general are.
But tell me, now let's look at another direction. How would this sit? What I'm worried about is, how generalizable are these results in an environment like Pakistan, where governance is so weak and the system of property rights and so many other things is so weak? How generalizable is this result? Is it only particular to the tax community, or can we generalize it to, let's say, security? Can we generalize it to... Because I remember Avinash Dixit had a book on public sector wages a long time ago, and he was very puzzled about the fact that how do you actually quantify the bottom line of government except in taxation? And that invariably the government performance is so hard and difficult and varied to measure, that once you get out of the tax framework, it's very hard to go in for a performance-based contract.
Yeah, so there are several questions you're raising here. Let's try and separate them out. Yeah. So one is this idea of a generalizability of results, right? So let me. So I have a view on that, which is I think we overplay that. I think we overplay that because a lot of us kind of are hoping for silver bullets, are hoping for things that can just be transplanted from place A to place B. And my view is that just as a myth we create. There are things we generalize, like the basic idea that incentives can work, the basic idea that, you know, how do you set up an evaluation design which will be informative? Sure. But the idea that you can replicate this and say, okay, now I should just scale this up everywhere, I think is just a myth we should stop believing.
Not doable.
Not doable.
Okay.
That said, so that sounds very disempowering. Yeah. Well, then what? But what is doable is to say, look, this is a think of what we did as a process of engagement. That process is very generic. We didn't set up the process to find scheme A worked or scheme B worked or scheme C worked. We set up the process to say, here's how we should think about this space. Here are the issues, exactly the issues you raised. It's a very complicated outcome space. So think of the last scheme I talked about. That was a very flexible scheme. It's exactly like the Wall Street bonus, right? You don't reward just on one thing. You reward on 50 factors, which are weighed in all sorts of complicated ways, but you allow the human to subjectively assess that, right? So we didn't take a stance. So the general lesson is, when you're in a situation like this, take a very broad span of interventions, right? So which span all these issues. Don't get stuck with, is it issue A or issue B, or debate it to death, which sometimes I feel like we do in Pakistan. Experiment, right? Set it up so that you can learn, which is what we did. Second, set the experiment in a way that the results are not controversial.
Okay.
It's very hard, hard science, if you will, in some sense, right? So what that does to me is it takes the process to be the generalizable thing, not the outcome of the process. And that I'm much more comfortable with. So you take the process of our engagement, you can totally replicate that process in all different tax departments, in the education department, in the health department. Right? What the sausage the machine pulls out or whatever it is, very different. Right? And in fact, it should look very different, right?
So you're saying that the randomized control experiment and you know, the methodology is applicable generally.
But also, remember, it's not just the experiment. Sometimes I feel like in this world, the RCT world is sometimes maligned, perhaps incorrectly, for being atheoretical. I actually think it's what is deep over here is the theory and the empirical design. They are both general. The theoretical setup, remember, how did we choose to do these three schemes? Where did that come from? That came from spanning the theoretical space to say, what is possible over here?
No, I agree. It's a method. It's a method. It's not a theory. I mean, you're using a method. The method is neutral. You've got to use it carefully, right? But let me take you in another direction. So we've got these results, and you say it's generalizable. That the issue is that in other areas of government, we may not be able to get as good measure of the bottom line as you get in revenue. But fair enough, we can get over that too. But tell me, I mean, in terms of what I worry about, I remember I was at the policy table for sure. 3 years, and we thought about these things too, and we thought about many issues. The one thing that always stopped me, and I stopped, for example, wealth tax and property tax, I stopped on a number of occasions, because I found that the potential for the tax man to game it, the system, and be able to prey upon the weak, the widows and orphans, etc., is very huge if you give the tax man the autonomy to decide on collection mechanisms, etc.
I understand where you're headed.
And how do you deal with that? I mean, the game theory version also has to be looked at, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you look at the details of our results, we were talking about earlier, is how do they collect taxes? So what happens is, there's a dark side to everything, right? What's the dark side to these results? The dark side is they raised taxes a lot without political disruption by targeting a few people. They raised a lot of money from a few people. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So now think of what's the underlying equilibrium? It's a bargaining game. Mm-hmm. It's a bargaining game between a tax collector and a taxpayer. Mm-hmm. Okay. In that bargaining game, if the bargaining breaks down, you are supposed to pay the official tax. If the bargaining happens, you collude and you pay the unofficial tax and you pay a bribe. So what do these guys do? For some people, they decide, we're not going to bargain anymore. My outside option has gone up. In other words, the government is paying more. Remember, the way we're structuring this is, it's odd. The outside option is the government's official wage. The hustle game that is happening is between you and the taxpayer, right? So for some people, you say, it's not worth it. I can get much more from the government. I don't want your bribe. You have to pay the full tax. And you hammer them fully.
It's very interesting. You know, I did a similar paper with Ratna Sahay in the fund. It's more theoretical. It's a paper game theory type thing, which is basically arguing fund programs used to cut public wages. And we did a paper to show that public wages should not be cut as a part of a fund program, primarily on the same argument that you're making, that if they are cut, it destroys the incentive of the tax collectors, and therefore, I just thought I'd throw exactly. an anecdote in, but it's very similar to the way you're thinking about it.
But here's the dark lining. What you see is that for people who you decide that they're not going to pay taxes, you will demand a higher bribe from them now. Yeah. And that we see that. We see there's a fraction of people who are actually not paying more taxes, but are going to pay higher bribe. Because what you've done is effectively you've empowered the tax collector. Mm-hmm. If you don't pay him the higher bribe, he'll say, well, then pay the full tax, right? Because when you pay the full tax, he gets a share of that as well.
No, but Asim, what worries me, and what I used to say at the policy table always, what worries me is my aunt sitting in Gulberg. My fictional aunt sitting in Gulberg, and we all have such aunts, whose husband left her a property. She's now 90 years old.
Sure.
The husband bought the property for
her. They have a rebate for the widow, and the person doesn't give her the widow.
And not only rebate. I mean, the point is that property is now worth $10 million, whereas when they bought it, it was $1,000 or something, right? 70, 80 years ago.
Absolutely.
Now, there is a deep incentive on the part of the tax collector and some land mafia or whatever to try and get that property. So if you empower the tax collector, as happened, that as we discussed many times, to go and collect a huge tax on that property, that widow has no option but to sell to somebody. And the tax collector is in a very good position to be able to arrange the situation that he can reward the land mafia and collect the bribe from that side rather
absolutely,
than from this side.
Absolutely. Look, so, I think we have to, my sense is in Pakistan, sometimes in the desire for perfection, we don't even do the low-hanging fruit, right? So there's a question.
That's everywhere. I mean, we face that issue in every country,
absolutely.
Even the U.S.
So my view is not to proceed like that, right? Mm-hmm. My view is to say, do we think these reforms are complementary to other sets of reforms? Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So let's take what you refer to now in the tax literature is this big desire of third-party data monitoring or third-party verification. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole bunch of introducing technology, right? My own sense in these things is that all these are complementary reforms. So the way I view what we did was to say, look, whatever you have to do, you have to get the tax collector's incentives aligned the right way. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to have that, whatever other reform you do, how much time we've spent trying to digitize, Patwari's
would
land?
Would it be correct to say, you see, the other side that worries me is that Pakistan government is very ready to jump on a quick result at the sea. And they've done this many times. Like, for example, taxing these cash payments from bank accounts.
Sure.
Seemed like a very sweet, quick deal. And I think it's destroyed the financial sector.
Absolutely. Right?
And they were setting up this withholding tax system. I know my friend, I won't name him, but he did it. And I used to argue with him all the time. But look, this withholding system is crazy. I mean, it's going to... But now they've expanded so much that it's kind of become a very regressive indirect taxation. Because even my driver, when he buys a mobile phone car, tells me, sir, I'm paying 40% tax to the government, right? Yeah. And part of it is 16% withholding income tax, which he will never get back. Right. So, and they've got withholding taxes on internet, et cetera, et cetera. So the point is, I'm worried that the government may jump on this. But I think you would add a word of caution, which you did in your Wilson paper, that this is not just one reform. Let's say a panacea or nothing.
In fact, that's what I was trying to say earlier. Yeah. That to me, you know, the process of using evidence. What we're trying to do at a very big meta level is to say, systematically navigate the space through proper process, which is informed by theory and empirical design, which is feasible to carry out in Pakistan, which makes you add more and more features. It's like, you know, you're an engineer and you're building the first machine, and the first machine is never perfect. You get something right, and then you start adding this hubris that you have the perfect answer is complete arrogance. There's no such thing. Fair. It's a process of improvement.
No, I appreciate
it. Where you start in that is doesn't really matter, actually.
Yeah.
We started with incentives. You could have started with digitization of data. Fair. You could have started with selection of people. Mm-hmm. But to say that that's sufficient and that's all you need to do is incredibly arrogant.
No, I think you put your finger in it. And this is something that, Asim, again, I'd like your comment on. Because when I was in the government, I used to face this question all the time. And I used to tell the government that the job of the civil servant is not to go about like a thanedar, like, for example, the issue of energy. Right? And the energy system, I remember I worked with many secretaries, and they felt that the best way they could, you know, make the energy system perform was to actually go and sit on top of the discos and the gencos and make the system work. And I used to tell them all the time, that's not your job. Let the guys who are managing the system manage the system.
Yeah.
As the railway minister, for example, at one meeting actually told me, so then what is my job? And I told him, I said, look, your job is to make policy. But he said, that's trivial. I said, no, that's the most difficult job in the world.
That's the hardest job.
You have to do this research. You have to go out and monitor the system. You have to collect the data. I said, your job is the whole year to sit silently doing research, thinking up options. You present a policy paper once in a while after you've collected enough evidence on the whole system as a whole, not just one a small fragment of it. Now, what do you think? The role of policy and the role of the bureaucracy and the government?
It's a great question. Now, one of the things I find very distressing, because I mean, not as much as opportunities as you have, and obviously you've engaged much more with the government. I mean, I've engaged in a very limited way.
Don't worry, my friend, you're young. Your time will come too.
My suggestion is
don't take it if it comes. But that's another subject.
Indeed. At least in my limited observation, what I would often see is exactly what you said, that every senior policymaker, I kept on thinking, where is strategic decision-making happening in this department? Who is deciding what are the important areas we should investigate? What are the important reforms we should do? How should we change and improve what we're doing? And mostly what I saw the senior decision maker was firefighting or dealing with some political pressure or getting into the weeds in exactly this grand inquisitor sense ke mera kaam ye hai ki main thanedar hoon aur main chote chote logon ko pakdunga ja ke dekho usko maine pakad liya. And I felt like saying, you are such a smart, skilled person, and all you're doing is basically this thanedari. Maybe for the British, this worked because they wanted thanedars. They didn't want to innovate. They didn't
create. Controlling a system. They were not making policy or doing
absolutely
things for the welfare of the people.
And then when you ask them that, because I've given lots of lectures at the National School of Public Policy. I run a program with them as well. Mm-hmm. And when I teach the senior most guys, I teach at multiple levels. Mm-hmm. So the NMC. Mm-hmm. You know, the grade 20 sort of promotion to 21 individuals. You know, when you look at even that level, it's interesting that often they absolve themselves of this responsibility by saying that's the job of the politician to inform, to make policies, to formulate policies. And I think, and when you ask the politician, they says, we don't know how to do it. We're simply doing constituency politics. So I feel like everyone is absolving themselves of what I think is one of the most fundamental roles of the state.
No, I'll tell you what they do. They leave it to the donor.
And that's sad because a donor is neither in the should be in the business of this, nor do they have the skill set to answer that question, nor do they have the right incentive structures. I think that's a real tragedy. Absolutely. This. I mean, aap IMF mein hain, you know this much better, but I feel like sometimes you take a place like the IMF, the World Bank, and you say, aapka yahan attitude hota hai ki ji, aap mai baap hain, ab jo bhi kahe hum kar lenge. Yahan aapka attitude hota hai ki you're the foreign devil, ab jo bhi kahenge hum nahi karenge.
No, no,
and both are terribly bad attitudes.
That's a very important point, and I've told them often. I mean, in fact, I said, describe the whole process that we do at the fund at the bank, for example. If the fund is going to make a policy change, let's say the global crisis has happened or whatever, right? We will initiate a big task force with our own team to try and come up with, the best research we can possibly do, and make a policy paper. We will even hire other consultants to come and help us. But eventually the policy paper has to be prepared by the staff and owned by the staff. Right. And that policy paper has to go to the board and then the board takes a decision. Now, the policy paper can contain randomized controlled trials, experiments, econometrics, whatever you have. The leeway is given that you use the best possible techniques and research and inform the board and come up with a decision, set of decisions that the board can take. The board's job is to take a decision, not to make policy.
Yeah.
Right? It's the same thing in the cabinet. I told the Prime Minister in the cabinet many times, your job is to give direction to this. Yes, you can give direction. Yes. But the research at policymaking is a civil servant's job. Trump is finding that out too. You can't make policy on your own, right? So yeah. That's an important thing. But let's leave that aside. We'll do that some other time, given that you're teaching at the staff college. We'll do one on that too. let me quickly ask you another question. A few quick questions so that we can close this. One thing is behavioral economics. Now, behavioral economics has a lot of different things to say about incentives, and I won't give you a lecture on that. I'm sure you know the stuff. And they say that bonuses are only one part of incentives. If I can think of it, I can divide into three. One is bonus, the other is it's satisfaction, job satisfaction, the third is autonomy, and the fourth is some Absolutely. Kind of recognition, right? So, I mean, broadly speaking, this is what behavioral economics shows. Now, how does your result sit with that?
That's a great question. Let me give you the sort of straight, honest answer first, which is we did not separately explore, think of like social status type primes, right? Imagine you were in education. I would be much more willing to say in education, we should have, how do you reward teachers? You could give them performance for test score increases, or you can give them social recognition or social status. That said, and we took a prior on that. That was, we felt the two big things in this dimension were money and transfers. So the two big monetary and non-monetary things we picked, and I put social status and behavioral things in the non-monetary category, right? But the non-monetary category we picked was also very tangible. It was your post. It wasn't what the world thought about you, right? That said, what is very interesting is when we gave these rewards in both the transfers and in particular in the performance pay, the pecuniary ones, we had big ceremonies. We gave these checks in a public setting, typically with the head of the department or even at times a minister coming in and handing out and saying, so-and-so, Nadeem from Flan Tax Circle did the best this year in performance. They have a check we're giving them, but we also want to acknowledge their performance. So there was a sense of social status there. We did not separate that out. So if you ask me what fraction of what we found was driven by that, it's hard for me to separate that out. But it comes back to kind of the iterative process. Could we set up a design to test that? Absolutely. Yeah. Is there literature talking about that being important? Absolutely. Mm. Is my prior that that's going to be big in tax? No. Mm. My prior is that's going to be big in social services more, like education and health. But, that's my prior. We should test it.
No, fair enough. I think, what you've done is very interesting and very informative. But I think the most important thing that you've done is not the results per se will always change and, context Absolutely. Will change, etc. That's not important. What is important is really, and I want to emphasize this because, as I tell you, my audience, hopefully is students and young researchers and people who are thinking to pick up research ideas, etc. I would say that what you have done is shown these kids methodologies that they should take. And elaborate upon, develop, whatever. Nobody should leave anything. Nobody should replicate everything perfectly, although there's a merit in replication too. But they should seek to develop it in their own local areas or wherever and take it forward. So I take your exercise much more important from the point of view of how policy should be made and how we should inform policy by good research. And I think that's a very good thing that you've done. But let me take you in another direction.
By the way, I just wanted a second. I think that's exactly how I would think about it as well. So that's a perfect way to summarize that. Great. So I agree
now,
completely.
Let me take you in another direction. I mean, the literature on civil service reform, I found when I read your paper that there you have, I mean, it's not your subject, but in any case, if you want to generalize your papers for civil service reform, then it's a wider subject and there's lots of material on that.
Yes.
I've written on that quite a bit. I think the key things to think about in the civil service reform is, first of all, the current structure, which is very, very, the way I look at it, it's like a trade union. It's a closed entry system. Right, where you, for example, tomorrow, the likelihood of you becoming finance secretary is very low. It has to be somebody from within the system. So it's not an open entry system. That's a big problem. The second issue is transfers is a big issue. For example, transfers is used as a coercive device to make civil servants do the right thing for the powers that be. And inevitably, it is to maximize corruption for the powers that be and to pick the right handmaiden for corruption. But that's the thing. But the second thing, the most important thing is the third thing, which is very important, that the civil service is not without its reward system. And most people mistake it to be underpaid. When we did the framework of economic growth, we actually calculated the pay of the civil service. Mm-hmm. And I think the civil service pay is not low at all. If you monetize their perks, if you monetize their other the plots and other things that they get, then the civil service pay, I think, is almost equivalent to what the fund and the bank pay, which is not a low pay. The key issue that we face, which goes back to incentive theory, you know, high-powered incentives or whatever, the high-powered incentive in the civil service system, which is cash, which is low. But by design, the part that maximizes their income, which is the plots and the perks, which are tax-free, then that they get in spades. For example, that constitutes almost 80% of their income, and that's totally tax-free. And that is used by the powers that be as an incentive, once again, to select civil servants for the right mechanism, which is to maximize their power, their corruption gains, etc. Now, how would you treat those? I know they're outside your purview.
It's a very fair point. I mean, I think the transfers papers very much treats one dimension of them. Mm-hmm. I think you've raised kind of, again, two different issues. One is to say it's not about level of pay, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, nor do we say whether people are over. In fact, in education, I actually think if you think of public school teachers, they're paid way more than private school teachers are.
I remember you showed it in the paper.
And, you know, I've worked on that. That's a separate conversation.
That's another podcast we have to do at some point. Yeah,
absolutely. Or, you know, the other great, Tahir and Rabi is another expert in that. And who's I've worked with on that. It's about the gradient of pay.
Right.
It's not about how much you're paid. It's whether your pay is tied to performance. Mm-hmm. So I think one issue is whether it's in the form of wages or in the form of land or whatever. We have the issue is that none of this is tied to performance in a systematic, objective, non-ad hoc way. Mm-hmm. And that's a fundamental problem. Mm-hmm. The second problem, which I think is also very interesting, is how fungible are different forms of payment? So even if, take the world where this was tied to performance, there is an inefficiency when you give people rewards. Now, there's a political equilibrium why that's there, which you alluded to. But for a second, just step aside from that to say, if you were to reward someone, why do you reward someone in goods which they may not be able to readily monetize? So for instance, if you say, I'm going to give you a gas allowance. If I don't travel as much, not as useful for me. I'm going to give you cooks and gardeners and chowkidars and like I go to all these government departments and they seem to have too many people working there.
Right.
If I could monetize that, if I could say instead of that, give me a higher salary. I don't need four people in my house. I just need one and the rest monetize their salary and give it to me in performance. So the form in which you pay when you add these non-pecuniary things sometimes create huge financial frictions because the market isn't, market can't exchange that into money easily.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's happening in these things is now the interesting thing is why is that a stable equilibrium? You know, like if anything, we probably have overemployed in the civil service, not at the high level, but at the lower levels, right? Mm-hmm. But that's an employment source then. So we have this weird political incentive, I think you alluded to this earlier, which is mixed up in that, which is we want to generate employment. So one reason why you might have 50 people in a government rest house doing all sorts of things when in fact you only need 5 or 10 is that some politician has got his or her person bhartid. Jab wo system chalega, to usko agar aap monetize bhi karne ki koshish karenge, there'll be a political resistance against that. Inko naukri kon dega? Agar aapne ye monetize kiya to a third of our or a fourth or half of our government employees at this level will be faragat. Wo kahan jayenge?
No, fair point. But I don't know whether you saw this or not. In the framework of economic growth and in the planning commission, I made an estimate, which I've tried to publicize a lot, but somehow I don't think it's got publicized. I got the government departments together exactly along the line that you're saying. Okay, how do we break the equilibrium? So I think the one way that I saw the equilibrium breaking was that the best land in every city is occupied by government servants for their private houses.
Interesting.
So now Islamabad, you take this land, which is huge. I got CDA, I got many departments involved. I didn't want to do it myself. You know, in government, it's no good doing things yourself. So you have to get the departments involved. So I got those guys and I said, you make the study. And I pushed them hard and we got a study kind of. It could be improved, but nevertheless, it was very indicative. That we found that in Islamabad, roughly 86 acres of contiguous land in big parcels was available in the form of houses of secretaries and various categories, not just secretaries, almost all categories. Even the lower class has houses in G5, which are fairly valuable land. So I said, okay, fair enough. What if we give them, monetize their salaries? Monetize their salaries means we have to give them a side payment that is enough to compensate them, not a cheap side payment.
How much would that money be?
That money, for example, I said, in the case of secretaries, would be like 4 or 5 lakh rupees a month.
Wow.
Which is a fair compensation, right? And then we worked out other grades too. So, I mean, it's a fair compensation. In fact, I wanted to be generous. I wanted to give them, we did cars and we did that generously, but that backfired. But it doesn't matter. We did this, said, okay, we'll monetize this at a generous price. And the cost was coming out, if I remember right, something like 37 or 40 billion rupees a year, which is fair enough, not that much. But on the other hand, when we took the land, and we said, okay, their first thought was, let's make it housing and sell as houses. I said, that's a stupid waste of time, of land. Let's make it into an organized, proper, commercial, complex scheme. So we left half the land empty and we created a crude sort of thing, but nevertheless. But the thing was interesting that if you allowed high rise of about 20, 30 stories and various parameters and left some land fallow, did this, that, etc., the investment possibility on that land in public-private partnership, whatever framework you choose, was something like 6 trillion rupees.
Wow.
That's almost $60 billion.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that kind of money, if you can raise, there's time to build, so it's not going to happen overnight. And how you do it, the biggest problem was I couldn't, because I realized that this is too much honey for the bees. You know, there'll be a huge amount of corruption in the process. Yeah, but if you can do it right, it's more than enough to compensate the civil servants and get a good equilibrium going.
Yeah, I mean, look, you talked about history. You don't need to go that far. I mean, the height of Islamic finance, Islamic science, or Islamic scholarship was when we had a system of endowing universities with waqfs.
Yeah.
That's exactly the same idea. When Al-Azhar Jamia Millia Islamia or Aligarh or something, I mean, these are places where we said, okay, we're going to give them resources to be able to leverage. Mm-hmm. You know, those resources will generate enough incomes that we can run, you know, the frontier of knowledge building.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, great. Asim, I think these are wonderful ideas. I think you've done some great work. Wonderful. I keep telling people like you, it's not just one podcast. I'd like to invite you to more. The purpose, as we talked about, is to throw out these ideas, debate them, and put them out so that people can understand the context of research. Because, you know, I find very few people read hard research papers. But it's up to, and one of our jobs is also to lay the context. And if you don't, research kind of gets lost. So thank you very much. This was wonderful. Really enjoyed it. And we'll do it again, inshallah.
Inshallah. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Nadeem, for
any
doing this.
Any last thoughts, any last ideas, please?
No, I think I wanted to end with the same idea that you said in the beginning, which is the lesson I feel younger researchers should get is not necessarily what are the answers the study reveals, but what's the process they took so that they can apply that process in their context. It's not that difficult to do.
And the important thing is they must apply it. That's the important
thing.
And generate, the more results we get, the harder we feel that we've learned something.
Absolutely.
You know, the more we learn, right?
Absolutely.
Now, finally, Asim, I ask everybody, and I should have told you this earlier, so I apologize for surprising you. But I think you don't need to worry about that. I ask everybody to offer my listeners a suggestion for a book, a movie, art, whatever has grabbed your imagination recently, what you think people should look at.
As a something to read?
Something to read, or even, I would say, even a movie, or whatever you like. Something that people can, they keep thinking, I'm talking about kids who are sitting out there who may not have the same access you do. So what would you recommend?
It's a tough one. You know, I guess there are so many people you could do, but, you know, one thing I would say perhaps is...
Whatever you like.
So let me make it more fun. Let me actually make a pitch to a friend of mine. So, you know, I enjoy reading fiction a lot. I love reading Pakistani fiction. And one of the books that I recently read, which I really loved, and I'll suggest that as a recommendation, is a book by Usama Siddiq.
I thought as much. Yeah, good. What's the name? Called, Shadow of the Moon or something?
No, Snuffing Out the Moon.
Snuffing Out the Moon. Okay.
And
okay.
The reason I like that book is... I'm biased. He's a really good friend of mine, but even more so, I feel like it's a book which takes serious look at history, but presents it in a very readable format. And I kind of love some of the underlying messages in that book. And I feel like it's your point, you know, how do we make what we're trying to say, which I think are fundamental questions or points or discussions in Pakistan, more accessible to people. And I feel like fiction has always been our traditional way of doing it. We have really powerful writers, of course, in the Urdu language. You know, I love that tradition. And I think, you know, this is kind of more a statement on the inability of individuals like myself, academics, to kind of reach out. I feel like more and more individuals doing that, producing that kind of work. Exactly what you said. These podcasts are one version of that. So I view his book as that. But
I'm very happy you recommended it. I'm guilty. I haven't read that book yet, but I do remember Osama describing the book to me when he was writing it. Number of times we've discussed it, and I always told him it's so innovative and fascinating. But now you just reminded me. I'm going to get it today.
I'm glad this was clearly not rehearsed on either of our parts. I'm glad it's spontaneous.
Wonderful. And by the way, I'll draw you to my book too, which is also fictional economics. So look at it if you can.
Absolutely.
Okay. Great. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.